capture the previous paragraph, where then would the temporary dwelling in the super physical take place?
Oh, maybe I'm wrong then.
I think
yes.
These paragraphs are so, I don't know, I read them and then I don't know if I read them, you know.
Yeah, the differences can be pretty subtle for my mind at least.
Well, just to kind of, in a sort of very summary way, kind of point out where we are, since we also have a newcomer today. Sri Aurobindo is talking here about the souls at this particular place where we are right now. Sri Aurobindo is talking about rebirth and the journey of the soul. So he's brought us to a point where he's asking the question, what happens to the soul between lives? And the answer can be one of a variety of places that the soul may go to. Firstly, we have a variety of traditions which give a certain kind of physicalist definition of where the souls go to. So, description of where the soul goes to. For example, you may have some idea of the soul roaming around in this world itself, some kind of a terrestrial location. But then he says that if there is some sort of annex to this terrestrial world that has been formed due to the soul's earthly sort of habitation, that is, we have imagined for ourselves some of these other worlds in earthly terms, then we may actually dwell in some kind of a terrestrial annex for some time, but it can't be for very long. The reason is that we have distinct vital and mental beings in us which belong more properly to the vital and mental worlds. And so he has brought this out, that once the vital and mental beings in us have developed safely, have a sufficient amarti, then the soul will not remain in the terrestrial zone beyond a certain period, free from the gravitation of the earth. The vital mental will rise up with the soul in it to its own normal or natural home. So it will spend some time, as it were, in the vital worlds. Because the tree, not to be modified in its intent by its, you know, sort of forced cohabitation with the body. So that is where we are at present. And this paragraph, where then would the temporary dwelling in the supraphysical take place, is addressing this question of where would soul go beyond its terrestrial habitation, location. So if we start there, I think it will be a good beginning to the journey of the soul outside of the earthly realm.
Sure, we can start there. Before we start, if somebody is not muted the microphone, can you mute it? I think most likely it's Shanta. Are you there? Shanta?
Yes, I'm hearing.
Yeah, so what you need to do is...
Yeah.
What you need to do is, up in the menu, you have file, account, call. Do you see those menus on top?
Yes.
So under,
I do see.
Yeah, so under call, there is mute microphone. Do you see that?
Yes, I see.
Yeah, so mute. What... Yeah, exactly. So what you want to do is, unless you're talking, you keep it in mute. So only the speaker is... only the person who's speaking has it in unmuted. So whenever you want to speak, you can unmute it and then say what you want, because otherwise there's an echo from your computer.
Okay, thank you. But I want to know which... this is Life Divine only, no?
Yes, Life Divine.
Which book? Life Divine, page number?
799.
799, because there's a, I'm just
sure.
introducing myself. So yeah, I will mute it and you can carry on. Yeah.
Yeah, and when you want to say something, you can unmute it and talk.
It's,
Vince,
it's
do
actually 798.
Yes.
Sorry, 798.
That's okay. Shall I start?
Sure.
Sure. Where then would the temporary dwelling in the supraphysical take place? What would be the soul's other habitat? It might seem that it ought to be on a mental plane, in mental worlds, both because on man the mental being, the attraction of that plane, already active in life, must prevail when there is not the obstacle of the attachment to the body, and because the mental plane should be, evidently, the native and proper habitat of a mental being. But this does not automatically follow, because of the complexity of man's being. He has a vital as well as a mental existence. His vital part, often more powerful and prominent than the mental. And behind the mental being is a soul of which it is the representative. There are, besides, many planes or levels of world existence, and the soul has to pass through them to reach its natural home. In the physical plane itself, or close to it, there are believed to be layers of greater and greater subtlety, which may be regarded as subplanes of the physical, with a vital and a mental character. These are at once surrounding and penetrating strata through which the interchange between the higher worlds and the physical world takes place. It might then be possible for the mental being, so long as its mentality is not sufficiently developed, so long as it is restricted mainly to the more physical forms of mind and life activity, to be caught and delayed in these media. It might even be obliged to rest there entirely between birth and birth. But this is not probable. It could only happen if and in so far as its attachment to the earth forms of its activity was so great as to preclude or hamper the completion of the natural upward movement. For the post-mortal state of the soul must correspond in some way to the development of the being on earth. Since this afterlife is not a free upward return from a temporary downward deviation into mortality, but a normal recurrent circumstance which intervenes to help out the process of a difficult spiritual evolution in the physical existence. There is a relation which the human being in his evolution on earth develops with higher planes of existence, and that must have a predominant effect on his internatal dwelling in these planes. It must determine his direction after death and determine too the place, period, and character of his self-experience there.
So, perhaps we had finished this paragraph before, but it's a good starting point because he's talking of the emergence of the subtle being out of its gravitation to the Earth's or terrestrial pull. And in this case, he reiterates something he has said before, which is very interesting, which is that this can only occur to the extent that these other sheaths in us, the vital or mental sheaths, have been sufficiently developed. Presumably, prior to that, what happens is that there is a rudimentary organization of the mental or vital being, too rudimentary to persist beyond the physical dissolution. So the physical being, as it were, itself provides a certain amount of organization. Say the animal has a certain physical organization of its vital life and its mental life. The human also has a physical organization of the vital life and the mental life, what we call the brain mind, for example, or the nervous system. Now, these systems, once dissolved, the question arises as to whether anything called mind or life, body, persists outside these physical organizations. If there isn't a sufficient amount of development of these kinds of bodies, what is known as the pranamaya sharira and the manomaya sharira, then one would say that in the physical, what is actually expressed in a life are universal forces that are flowing through without any consistency. There isn't any kind of identity to either the thinking or the life activities. They are just certain channelings without any sort of consistency of the physical organization. But if there is a certain kind of formation of the vital and mental being in itself, by itself, which uses the physical organization to express itself to some extent, then with the dissolution of the body, these sheaths tend to seek their fulfillment in their own natural or native worlds. And that is what he's talking about. Now, prior to that, he's talking about an intermediate stage where, again, it's another kind of annex to the physical world, a subplane, as he says, of the physical with a vital and mental character. So there may be a sojourn in such worlds. But this part was quite interesting in the sense that, as he says, we are not a being who has plunged from a mental or vital world into this world, into the earth world, and therefore, you know, inevitable sort of is our return to those worlds, but we are a being who develop out of the materials of nature, vital bodies and mental bodies, in their evolutionary emergence, so that only to the development, degree of development, are they fit to move into those worlds and persist there, endure there, with the psychic being at its center.
Devashishda, so in the middle, I'm reading the line, but this is not probable and could only happen if and in so far as its attachment to the earth forms of its activity was so great as to preclude or hamper the completion of the natural upward movement. So he's suggesting that, is he suggesting that a lack of development is what makes it linger longer in the subtle plane, in the subtle physical planes?
Well, he's suggesting two things there. One is what you just said, but the other, in that very sentence, I'm glad you brought that up, is what he calls its attachment to the earth forms of its activity. So, it may be that these nature sheets are formed to some extent, not if they were independently formed to a high extent, then it is almost inevitable that it will seek its own fulfillment in its own worlds. But if it is still formed in a rudimentary way, but for some reason its activities here on earth through its earth instruments have a compelling attraction for it. See, there are various circumstances where that may happen. And earlier in this very chapter, we have considered cases where he has a sort of mentioned that certain unnatural conditions may cause transmigration to take place very quickly. In other words, there is almost a sudden jump from one physical life to another physical life. That would happen, for example, we took up two cases. One is an accidental case, there is an accidental death without a sufficient development of the life and mind instruments that were assumed in this particular life, so that the same instruments would almost rapidly enter into another human birth. Or if it was the case that there was a very strong movement of life, movement of some kind on earth, like a revolutionary movement, a patriotic movement, or some kind of ideological movement in which one was so intensely attached that the dissolution of the body was not enough for the mental and vital sheaths to become free of that attachment. So it would tend to live or re-inhabit that kind of condition as soon as it can in another physical body. So these kinds of lives may also lend themselves to this explanation that you're talking about here, that there is such an attachment to the earth forms of its activity that it does not get released from the earth. The third one may be in intense attachment to some human being or beings, a family, for example, which causes a sort of a subtle body to persist for a certain greater or lesser period in the earth atmosphere. But usually, stories of ghosts, etc., are more romanticized than true. We would like to believe that people who pass away are more attached to us than they really are in the truth of their being. In actual matter of fact, it is remarkable how quickly the vital and mental beings put aside the physical circumstances of life and move into other worlds, as if into other, countries.
So when you say quickly, has Sri Aurobindo spoken about, these time frames, or is it... you mean in a relative way compared to what normally we think of?
Always in a relative way, but Sri Aurobindo has spoken very little about these kind of time frames. It is more in the mother's works that one finds more detailed accounts of the afterlife and of what happens to the soul, and various hints here and there. Unfortunately, not too many people have even queried the mother, from whom one could have got enormous wealth of understanding about these things. I was fortunate to be with Kirit Joshi yesterday at Ahmedabad, and he was talking about some such things. And, the fact that it is only when asked that she sort of talked about these things, and that there is a wealth of knowledge that she has left behind, very little of which has actually been published due to the nature of things that have been published. But the fact is that when we are talking about relative, the earthly circumstance and the impression of the earthly life, the earthly memory, fades very quickly after death, in the words of the mother. And what happens is that the vital and mental sheath, after this brief sojourn that he's talking about in the sub-worlds, in the annexes of the terrestrial, very soon move into astral planes of the vital and mental worlds.
Thank you, Devashishtha.
Devashishtha, between the strengths of vital and mental sheaths, This paragraph seems to suggest basically like vital part more often more powerful and prominent than the mental. So is that the reason behind a lot of emphasis on bhakti and type of thinking in Vaishnava traditions? Is that the reason why? Because there are also a lot of times you hear stories of people trying to remember Narayana in the last minutes, and because of their devotion towards Narayana, that way they can have a safe passage and things like that.
Yes, Sitaram, not only that, but as the mother has pointed out, the psychic being is in its subtle physical location just behind the emotional being. So in a way, the intensity of emotion connects very quickly to something in the psychic being. So that becomes a channel of remembrance through which the psychic's intention can be channelized. You see, so that is partly the reason why very effective means have been developed by bhakti traditions to intensify the connection with the psychic through emotions.
Hello, Devda.
Yes.
Hello, Devda. Yeah.
Yes.
I have got two questions. Could you give me slight examples of subtle physical and subtle vital? I am a little confused about it. Maybe I am very new to these two very important terms. And second, is a psychic being is quite developed to differentiate all these things in lower anima, lower strata of the beings? Thank you.
Yes, yes. Roughly speaking, Shanta, in a nutshell, the human psychology, according to Sri Aurobindo and following Indian psychology, is something which has an external and internal part. So we have an outer, as we can see. Firstly, we have a physical being that is visible to everybody through the senses. And in the physical being, there is a physical organization of the life activities and the mental activities, as I said. So we have a nervous system, we have a certain emotional system, limbic system, as they say, which is partly mental, and we have a brain system. So these are the physical organization of the mental and vital beings in us. Now, what the Indian psychology says is that due to the emergence of consciousness on earth, life emerged in matter, mind emerged in life. There are other kinds of subtler bodies that have developed. And in the human being, these coexist with the physical body. So the what is called the vital body is part of the, so before that, one must say, so we have the physical body, which is, you know, in the Sanskrit sort of terminology known as Annamaya Sharira.
Annamaya.
Now, Annamaya Sharira has two components to it. One is Sthula, and the other is Sukshma. Sthula means gross, or that which appears material, materiality of the earthly kind is present there, and sukshma is subtle. Now, that subtle body is actually what we're talking about as the subtle physical, or the subtle sheath. So this subtle body is actually a kind of a, it's almost material. It's got a physicality to it, but it's very subtle. It's kind of like a physical that is hardly visible with the naked eye, but subtler vision can see it. You can see it if your vision becomes more inward. You can see that we all talk about auras and things like that. Usually the aura, of course, is not exactly the subtle body. The aura is the expression of the vital body. But inside this subtle physical sheath, there are two other sheaths. One of them is the vital sheath of pranamaya sharira, and the other is the mental sheath or the manomaya sharira.
I think now, she got, Devashish, I think she got cut off. Let me just add her once more. Sorry. I don't see her online anymore, so maybe I'll add her.
I see her, Sham. Let's see, I can see her, she's online in my sort of system.
Maybe she didn't accept our invitation.
See,
can just call
her. Yeah, I see that you're calling her.
Yeah, try it.
Okay, maybe she's got disconnected. So what we can do is continue our reading, and if she comes back, I will continue with my description of the inner sheaths.
Sure. Always.
She's calling me. 1 minute. Let me just put you on hold and get back to you. Okay. So I'm continuing where we left off. There was a little hiatus, but I was talking about the fact that within the subtle body, like an envelope or a bag, you may say, contain the vital and mental body. These are sharidas. Now, all these together, so a subtle physical with the subtle vital and the subtle mental within it, and the gross physical as an outer envelope of this entire system, comprises what one calls the nature body of man, or of the human being. This is the nature instrument, antahkarana, inner instrument. Uses this instrument, that is the dweller within, the Dehin. So the dweller within is the psychic being. Now, I'm not going into greater detail. If and when necessary, we can go into the detail of how the psychic being is formed. But in essence, the psychic being is the spark of God in us, which evolves from in. A psychic being is soul, it's a thing. So it has some amount of mentality, vitality and physicality to it. When we talk about a psychic nature or a soul mentality, a soul vitality and a soul physicality. Now, your second question was very interesting because it relates centrally to what we are talking about, rebirth and the other worlds. The second question, if I got it right, was, does the soul have any true understanding of these lower nature sheaths? Am I right, Shankar?
Yes, you are right. Yeah.
Yes.
Is it well developed to understand its own experiences?
Yes. So, yeah, the reason why this is very interesting is that in the development of the soul as a spark or an essence plunges into the ignorance, actually into the inconscient, which is to it an incomprehensible reality. You see, it is not understood by it. So when it plunges into this nature, you know, sort of being into nature, it goes through an evolutionary process in which it gathers understanding about nature. This is the formation of the psychic being, in fact. The psychic personality evolves. And as it evolves, its evolution is a greater and greater understanding, knowledge, and control over the nature instrument. See? So this evolution causes the psychic being to form more and more into itself, and as it forms, it also controls more and more of the nature. In other words, the nature becomes more under its control, you see. So this is a process of evolution which rebirth is all about. This is the very essence and meaning of rebirth, one may say.
Thank you, Dada.
That was a really good question, I thought, and a very nice answer.
Okay, so should we continue?
Sure. Shanta, do you want to read the next paragraph? Okay. Sharma, do you want to read next?
Yes. It may be also that he may linger for a time in one of those annexes of the other worlds created by his habitual beliefs, or by the type of his aspirations in the mortal body. We know that he creates images of these superior planes, which are often mental translations of certain elements in them, and erects his images into a system, a form of actual worlds. He builds up also desire worlds of many kinds to which he attaches a strong sense of inner reality. It is possible that these constructions may be so strong as to create for him an artificial post-mortal environment in which he may linger. For the image-making power of human mind, its imagination, which is in his physical body only an indispensable aid to his acquisition of knowledge and his life creation, may in a higher scale become a creative force which would enable the mental being to live for a while amid its own images until they were dissolved by soul's pressure. All these buildings are of nature of larger life constructions. In them, his mind translates some of the real conditions of the greater mental and vital worlds into terms of his physical experience, magnified, prolonged, extended to a condition beyond physicality. He carries, by his translation, the vital joy and vital suffering of the physical being into supraphysical conditions in which they have a greater scope, fullness, and endurance. These constructive environments must therefore be considered, so far as they have any supraphysical habitat, as annexes of the vital or of lower mental planes of existence.
Yes, now I realize that we have actually finished this paragraph before. And this was the paragraph to which Sitaram had asked the question about the ancestors, and also the question regarding Savitri, I think maybe Shyam had asked, regarding, the description of the worlds in Savitri. And also we had discussed a little other descriptions of the worlds, such as in the Christian idea of heaven and hell. I think Vince had asked that question about purgatory. And also in poetic ideas such as that of Dante, when he talks about the Paradiso and the Purgatorio. So
you also mentioned about jihad.
Yes, we also mentioned about the worlds of the heaven and hell worlds related to militancy and jihad and things like that. So, yes, these are, as he says, either collective or individual domains, just as there are annexes to the terrestrial subtle world, so too to the mental and vital worlds, there are annexes that have been formed by human imagination, that have given certain human forms, or actually earthly forms, to the realities of these worlds. The actual realities of these worlds are much subtler. They change form and shape. They are ideas that can take many forms, or fluid forces that can actually manifest themselves through a number of material symbols. When we fluid forms, we actually make buildings that somehow transition between terrestrial, rigid, material forms and the native forms of these realms. They are approximations or translations of realities that are native to their own world in terms of our earthly worlds. So through all those, pointing to the fact that there may be temporary journeys in these worlds as well, which are in some way related to the kind of close connection between these worlds and our human worlds. Dissolved by the soul's pressure. That part is very interesting, which makes for the fact that these imaginations have a temporary sort of permanence on the soul's life. The soul cannot live in these worlds and exerts its pressure for truth and ultimately dissolves them.
But if someone was asking...
A real safeguard, this actually brings up a very big issue, which is really the issue of all the various dangers of wrong worlds, alternate worlds, imaginary worlds in which we may find ourselves. and what is the safeguard, really? So actually, whether in life or out of life, the real safeguard is the psychic being. So soul, a psychic being, is the unfailing and unerring guide that leads us towards the truth. And all these kinds of accretions that we create with our imagination, or the false worlds into which we may be pulled, even if they exert a certain pressure and a certain fascination on our nature, cannot ultimately hold against the soul's pressure. So to the extent that the soul or psychic being is well developed, one spends less time in these kinds of worlds.
So these must be the vital worlds, right? Or maybe the mental vital worlds.
Well, here he's talking about not even true vital worlds, but annexes of the mental and vital worlds
that are sort of translations or creations due to earthly imagination.
Devda? Hello?
Yes, Shanta, yes.
Devda, I want to ask one more thing. Does that mean up there, there is no religious attachments or anything? A soul, whether in this world, may belong to any religion, but goes only to one common sojourn. Is it so?
Yes, this is true. But also there is another aspect to it, which is that these vital and mental worlds, in their reality, would also, you know, vision themselves to us through a certain amount of relativity, depending on the mental and vital sheath that we have developed. So, though it is true that some of these worlds, what he's talking about, are very evidently created by the religious imagination, still, even the truth of these worlds, the true worlds, are actually being represented to us through our own nature bodies, our mental body or our vital body. Just as with our physical body, we see trees, green grass and buildings and all that, they are representations to our senses. So too, we have mental senses and vital senses through which the realities of these worlds are received by us. So to what extent those realities are the same for all human beings? That becomes the question. The same realities may be figured differently to different people, depending to some extent on the nature of the inner being. So, you know, this is a very interesting subject, which ultimately, you know, even the beginnings of modern art sort of acknowledge this kind of perception. You see, Cezanne, for example, said that why should I paint a round plate? I never see a plate as round. So he was asserting his subjectivity, and as a result, you know, or he said, you know, I see the plate in a different color than what, you know, people represent it as. So that is where the subjective being, to some extent, receives the impressions of these vital and mental worlds slightly differently, but it is receiving the same realities.
Thank you, Dad.
Devashista, when we say it depends on the person's imagination as opposed to just being an excess of the mental and vital worlds, so the imaginations in general should also belong to some plane, right? I mean, they're a projection of some plane, correct? In that case, of what plane?
They are, but they are constructions, you see. So, for example, they are, I mean, projections of some plane. That's why they are annexes of the vital or mental plane. So, what is happening here is a kind of a hybrid reality. A hybrid reality between material existence and vital existence, or material existence and mental existence. This is what gives it a certain kind of material concreteness, like Lota was saying, you know, the pearly gates, the streets of gold and all that. But at the same time, there are certain kinds of ideas that are coded into it that belong to our, you know, ideological investments. So it is a kind of a creation of mental and vital and physical hybrid that, due to the belief of large numbers of people, have taken on a reality in a province. It's like a kind of a separate province of the vital world closer to the material world. It did not have reality before that, but has been given reality due to a certain hybrid, you know, construction of the human journey.
Yeah. Thank you, Devashista.
Devashista, did mother say anything, or maybe you know from somewhere else that What happens to people who have had some accident or something and then the body goes in coma? But I would say that it's just the body that is left on the earth and the rest has gone somewhere else.
This could happen. I vaguely recollect she has talked about some instances like this. But she has also talked about the fact that sometimes such a being roams around in the subtle physical or in the physical itself in with the subtle body and may not even know that he has lost his body or the body is in coma until there is some rude shock of some kind where it realizes that it cannot do certain physical things that others are doing. It may also be that there is a plunge into the inconscient, see, that is in the comatose stage could lead not only to a journey into other vital and mental world, but also into a deeper zone of the inconscient.
So you don't think that the person has actually died and because of medical advances, people have managed to keep the body alive, but actually the body is a dead body. It's just breathing because of some miracle.
Well, not in all cases, because we know certain very interesting cases where a person has come back to life after a number of years even.
But that is difficult to say, you know, because there are so many other vital beings who are waiting for the opportunity to take on somebody else's body and live for a while.
Yeah, that may be, but you see, comatose condition, entering into coma is not necessarily a death. Coma may be just a flooding of the nature instrument and particularly the physical instrument. And putting it or pushing it into a state of suspension, you know, so one cannot conclude that coma literally means death.
Jetha, can we say that the psychic being wants such an experience also for a coma interest person?
It's possible. Yes, it's possible.
Yeah. But what is the psychic being gathering? Of course, I'm just trying to equate action and acquisition of knowledge and acquisition of experience as the psychic being's aim, but maybe it's not right.
No, you're right, because you see, everything that is happening is to some extent the experience of the psychic being. It's really the true experiencer in us is the psychic being. We are having other kinds of experiences with the nature instrument and thinking that that is our experience. But as a matter of fact, the true experience is that of the psychic being. And the reason that it's having its experience is to gather greater and greater knowledge and power. So even the experience of death, or what is ultimately the experience of death for the psychic being, it is the compulsion to the disappearance of the nature body, right? Even the disappearance of the physical and mental sheaths is ultimately a compulsion to the disappearance of the subtle sheaths. Now, psychic being in its development gathers experience of these kinds of dissolutions, but it also moves towards a gathering of greater power so that it does not necessarily remain a compulsion. That is the first step towards immortality. Actually, first step towards immortality is knowledge of the psychic being. But the second most important step towards the transformation of the idea of immortality is what is called Ichha Mrityu. In other words, there is no longer the compulsion to the dissolution of physical, mental and vital. So all these kinds of experiences, including the comatose stage, is an experience of the psychic being in its journey towards mastery over these particular compulsions.
Vishishta, regarding physical body as a protection towards the lot of these forces that exist outside, and without this physical body, the psychic being cannot last really that long, you know. I heard that type of explanation somewhere. Basically, it is the reason why the soul that leaves the physical body needs to find another body pretty quickly, because it cannot really last that long without that protection. Is there any truth to that type of thinking?
Sita, no, you see, if you remember earlier in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo is pointing out that what you just talked about is transmigration. And that happens to beings whose psychic being hasn't really formed. In other words, the psychic entity is there, but the nature sheaths are not sufficiently formed, and the psychic personality is not sufficiently formed. So, depending on these two things, two factors, the well-developed inner bodies and the well-developed psychic personality will also depend the amount of what you are calling necessity of the protection of this psychic entity by other sheaths, or how quickly it needs to reincarnate. Now, what Sri Aurobindo is saying is that prior to the emergence of the psychic being, the psychic entity more or less immediately has to reincarnate in another physical vital complex, or whatever it has managed from this physical vital complex rushes along with the psychic entity within it into another kind of being. So that is the transmigration that takes place. It is only with the appearance of the human being that both the nature sheaths as well as the psychic being has a psychic entity has developed sufficient personality. And then it can persist outside the physical. And that's why at that point, there is a certain escape from the gravitation to physical bodies and an entry into these domains in their own right. So firstly, the vital being can dwell in the vital world for some time. The mental being can dwell in the mental world for some time. And the psychic being itself can dwell independently. And that's the reason why it goes to sleep in the psychic world. That cannot happen when just the psychic entity is there.
So the key is how well developed this psychic entity is. That's the key.
How much of a personality it has developed. That is the psychic being. This is the distinction between the psychic entity and the psychic being.
That means the well-developed psychic being will not go into an animal being once again. Is
yes,
it so?
Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Devashishri, relating to the same topic, talking about other philosophies, some of the masters talked about, let's say, an entity leaves the body and the soul wanders away, or whatever we are talking about, certain period of time, it's outside the body. And then when it is entering the body, it is understood that that soul coming inside will be starting from where it left. It is left off the development. Is that anything related with this?
Can't really start.
Yes. Yes, it is. You see, that is the whole idea about the karma, because the impression of a certain life on the psychic being, it can leave its mark, because you see the psychic being absorbs or assimilates the lessons of a life that its instruments give it. So depending on physical, vital and mental experiences in a certain life, the psychic physicality, vitality and mentality develop a certain amount of power and a certain amount of need for more experience.
So that need for more experience is expressed in the next life. But where your question, you know, maybe what, there are two aspects to your question. One is that what does it mean? Does it mean when we start off where we left off, does it mean that the soul has already gathered a certain experience and now it needs more experience? Yeah. If that is what it means, the answer is yes. The other possibility is, does it mean that it is going to take the same kind of nature that it had in its previous life and going to develop this further? The answer to that is no. The reason is that it sheds its physical, mental and vital sheaths, and only in very rare cases it takes them up again. Usually it takes up a totally new vital and mental sheath as well as a new physical sheath, only bringing the experiences of the psychic being to bear on that new nature.
So in other words, Beethoven, for example, doesn't have to, like, if he can pick up a different experience, if his soul needs something to do with this time, to say art related or painting related, it can pick up that experience, not necessarily something to do with jazz, right?
Yes, undoubtedly. In fact, Mother has said that some people like that, in fact, she has mentioned Beethoven since you brought him up himself, they develop certain parts of their nature so strongly that that nature personality is so strong that not only does it persist beyond the death of the body, it persists for a long time after even the soul has moved on into another life. Independently, Beethoven's hands may have a subtle formation which are so strong that they are kind of in the air. These are certain what one might call astral formations that seek for other beings through whom they can manifest themselves. Now, Beethoven himself in his next life may or may not take up that particular formation into his own constitution. That depends on the psychic being and its own choice.
Debashista, what is astral? I mean, is it one of Sri Aurobindo's terminology?
Sri Aurobindo also uses this term off and on. Mother uses this term more often. Astral is much more used in modern sort of, you know, kind of these parapsychology terminology, vocabulary. Astral can mean just subtle physical or any of these other worlds which have to do with extraterrestrial or extra material existence.
So it doesn't have a specific connotation of being a synonym for vital or any such specific other world that is there in Sri Aurobindo's terminology.
No, no. Usually the word astral can either mean subtle physical or it can mean vital. These are the two general terms in which it is used. But no, it doesn't have a very specific, as far as I am, you know, my understanding, it doesn't have a very specific, you know, connotation in Sri Aurobindo's terminology.
And the more general question to that is it really, I mean, at a broad level, should there be corresponding terms in each other's terminology, or is the worldview that even the CSC is fluid enough that it may be different for different people?
That's a very good question. And actually, we've touched on this question earlier. Answer is yes, it is and it should be fluid for different spheres. But one should understand what is the context in which it is being used, what is the system and what is the meaning. Same words in Sanskrit, for example, have over time been used to mean a variety of different things. And we may say that in a way there has been a kind of a falling off of original meanings. But if we understand the system within which that word operates, then it is possible to accept its alternate meanings, and only one has to know how to translate between them. It becomes very complicated if there's many systems in which the same word is used differently. But that is part of the nature of the world. And, you know, rather than insist that everybody use words in the same way, the growth of consciousness, particularly the growth of mental consciousness and ultimately the growth of experience, is something that should make us engage with words in such a way that we can immediately pick up what that meaning is in a particular context. This also relates to what we are talking about and what we talked about earlier regarding the sensing apparatus and the other fluid worlds of mind and life. It's only in the material world that mental operations insist on a certain kind of standardization. In their own worlds, mental operations often have a much greater flexibility where they can use a variety of symbols to express the same thing. So ultimately, developing that capability, that capacity to be flexible about words and understand in what context intuitively it means something is part, I feel, of the growth of consciousness necessary.
That is such a beautiful answer, Devashishtha. Very nice.
The growth of a language sensibility, one may say. You see, partly that is the reason why, you know, mother insisted on people developing a language sensibility, and in Pondicherry, many people have this language sensibility of knowing a number of languages. But I think that's just the fringe of the capability I'm talking about, where one indeed, the whole consciousness of language sensibility must be such that our own consciousness is master of the body of language. You see, we can take language and realize that it doesn't constrain us with meanings, that meaning are what we give to words and what a variety of people have given to words, and therefore possible for us to understand differently according to our entry into those worlds.
Yeah, beautiful. Jyoti, would you like to read the next paragraph?
I don't even have the book in front of me. Sorry.
I can read. Okay. So this is the paragraph starting with, but there are also true vital worlds, correct?
Yes.
But there are also the true vital worlds, original constructions, organized developments, native habitats of the universal life principle, the cosmic vital anima, acting in its own field and in its own nature. On his internatal journey, he may be held there for a period by force of the predominantly vital character of the influences which have shaped his earthly existence. For these influences are native to the vital world, and their hold on him would detain him for a while in their proper province. He may be kept in the grasp of that which held him in its grasp, even in the physical being. Any residence of the soul in annexes or in its own constructions could be only a transitional stage of consciousness in its passage from the physical to the supraphysical state. It must pass from these structures into the true worlds of supraphysical nature. It may enter at once into the worlds of other life, or it may remain first as a transitional stage in some region of subtle physical experience whose surroundings may seem to it a prolongation of the circumstances of physical life, but in freer conditions proper to a subtler medium and in some kind of happy perfection of mind or life or finer bodily existence. Beyond these subtle physical planes of experience and the life worlds, there are also mental or spiritual mental planes to which the soul seems to have an internatal access and into which it may pursue its internatal journey. But it is not likely to live consciously there if there has not been a sufficient mental or soul development in this life. For these levels must normally be the highest the evolving being can internatally inhabit, since one who has not gone beyond the mental rung in the ladder of being would not be able to ascend to any supramental or overmental state, or if he had so developed as to overleap the mental level and could attain so far, it might not be possible for him to return so long as the physical evolution has not developed here an organization of an overmental or supramental life in matter.
So, there Sri Aurobindo is giving us a clue to the real utility of the soul's journey in these worlds. Because indeed, the psychic being in its evolution, and we must go back and say the psychic entity in its evolution, is here ultimately to bridge heaven and earth, is ultimately here to occupy all these rungs of the world's stair, as Sri Aurobindo calls it in Savitri, so that the Purusha, the Isha, can actually make his habitation through each individual as the cosmic and transcendental being in life. The only thing this can the way this can happen is if we form such a habitation in us, a possibility of habitation in us. It is not given to us. We start off as this spark. But we, as we develop the soul personality, our power over nature as it is manifested increases. As that power increases, we start receiving influences from these superphysical worlds. We manifest them in the physical world. We cause to be expressed things which are foreign to the material world in our human lives and in our collective lives due to individual expressions. Now these influences and powers which operate in our physical lives have a certain degree of greater or lesser hold on our vital and mental beings, so that once the physical sheath falls off, we enter into these worlds and actually experience the operations of these forces, beings and influences in their native realm, in their native way. By doing this, again, the true experiencer within us, the psychic being, manages to integrate some of these experiences into itself. It is the ability to integrate these experiences that makes the psychic being capable in its next journey, in its next life, next birth, to have a greater access to these realms. It is only to the degree that these realms have become assimilated into the psychic personality, the existence of the psychic personality, that it is made capable to enter into ultimately the supramental worlds, the worlds beyond the mind worlds. That's the reason why he's saying gradual expression more and more of these higher worlds in our physical world is necessary, even in a universal sense, in the sense of ordinary humanity and its nature, so that the bridge may be built whereby the soul may ultimately be able to manifest the supramental here on earth. If that doesn't happen, always these higher worlds are available to the soul, but not in a bridged form, in a form in which we must exceed our physicality and the ambit of our expression or manifestation and leap into some other orbit with which we will have no contact. This, in terms of avasthas, is called sushupti. This is the reason why, in Aurobindonian terms, the phenomenon of sushupti is a shifting phenomenon. The limits, the boundaries of sushupti are shifting. They are not meant to be some kind of fixed line beyond which we enter into the sort of, you know, the cutoff line between the manifest and the unmanifested.
Devashishti, Devashish? Hello?
Yeah, he seems to have gotten cut. Let me try to add him again.
Sure.
Of these worlds in the physical world, the ability of the soul to become familiar with these worlds builds a bridge, a transition, creates a formation between our earthly existence and the highest mental worlds. Without this, we would actually be able to enter into the higher worlds, but only in samadhi. That kind of a samadhi would ultimately break the sort of, you know, kind of link between our wakeful existence and these existences beyond. So the formation of this inner link, the inner world, inner province, to bring into the Swapna Jagat more and more of what lies beyond in the Sushupti is part of this formation. And this formation ultimately helps us to mobilize these worlds in our Jagrat, and ultimately helps also for the supramental entry into the supermind in a wakeful state.
Oh, Devashish?
This one's.
I was starting to get the idea that, like, things are very subtle. I was reading the Methods of Vedantic Knowledge, and it reminded me of that, your last thought previous to this. To this thought, you were talking about words and what they represent.
Yes.
And he's talking here about reason and sruti and metaphysics. And he says, In this way, they avoided to a certain extent the besetting sin of metaphysics, the tendency to battle in the clouds, because it deals with words as if they were imperative facts instead of symbols, which have always to be carefully scrutinized and brought back constantly to the sense of that which they represent.
Yes.
I'm thinking, Sanskrit's kind of like that, isn't it? I mean, in the terms that you can interpret it, as I see it, not knowing the language, you can interpret it in certain ways, and that dictionaries are used, are grouped by words that have the same meaning, rather than... I mean, there's certain like roots in Sanskrit which can refer to a lot of words.
Yes.
And it's not such a precise thing.
Yes, actually it can be very precise, but at the same time, the precision is operating at a variety of levels. So it can have different meanings, or words can have different meanings depending on the level at which it is being perceived and expressed. To take a very simple example, the word vijnana, okay? Now, the word vijnana makes its appearance in the Upanishads. It's quite a prominent word in the Upanishads. But if you see the history of the word starts changing its meaning pretty quickly, okay? And you find an intermediate use of the word vijnana, which relates it to a kind of, you know, vishesh jnana, in other words, specified knowledge, or specialized knowledge.
Okay.
And ultimately, it ends up meaning science in modern times. Okay. Now, over in the Upanishads, and this has been one of the difficulties, if you look carefully at the use of the word vijnana, you find that Sri Aurobindo's sort of explanation of this word, description of this word, makes it out to be, in a sense, the supramental knowledge, the primary supramental knowledge. He says it is the knowledge of the essence, truth, and whole of reality. So this kind of whole knowledge, knowledge of the divine, by the divine, the one and the many within itself, is what he calls vijnana. Now, jnana in a more fundamental sense, without the prefix v to it, would refer to a knowledge by identity, which ultimately is not specified at all. In other words, it cannot know the many within itself. It knows only itself without any self-consciousness. Okay? As soon as self-consciousness emerges, what we call knowledge emerges. So knowledge, in its original emergence, is what the Upanishads are calling vijnana. But later, so many other meanings come to attached to that word. And if one is confused about it, one cannot understand what are the various levels at which it is being used, one will be completely confused. And this has happened. In fact, if you read modern translations of the Upanishads, including, say, Radha Krishnan's translation, you find that he hasn't been able to grasp this meaning of vijnana at all. He thinks they are talking about the intellect.
Yeah, okay.
So this is both the difficulty and the fertility of Sanskrit terms.
I mean, it seems when you read different interpretations of Sanskrit, it's like, I mean, even if you knew it yourself, like I'm speaking for myself, it's just so subject to interpretation. I mean,
yes, it is, and that's the reason why what he's talking about there.
Yes, please.
Hello?
Yeah. Yeah, we can hear you.
Yes. Yeah, I was saying that's the reason why in that what you're talking about, he's making the case for always relating terms to experiences. What do you mean by that term? There has to be an experiential component that you can attach to that particular term. I think maybe we should call off for today. You know, unless there is any more comments on the previous paragraph, and call off for today.
Sure, we can stop with a brief meditation.
Sure.